ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Science Show, who on the human family tree should be named Homo, like we are?
Find out how fast-flowing rivers can damage the environment, even way out in the ocean.
Hear the story of a pair of artist sisters in the 1800s who busted into the male-dominated world of botany.
And a museum mystery. Who was the man who stole hundreds of rare butterfly specimens 70 years ago? And why on earth did he do it? I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Robin, it's not often we get to report good news about the Great Barrier Reef, but I was really interested in a report that came out last week that showed that monsoonal rains late last summer helped reduce some of the heat stress that the corals were experiencing, particularly in the northern parts of the reef. But of course, you know, this is just a short-lived phenomenon.
Someone trying to make a long-term difference to the Great Barrier Reef is Dr. Jennifer Matthews from the University of Technology in Sydney. She became enraptured by coral reefs when she went on holiday in Thailand, diving, learning how reefs support about 7,000 other species, the beauty. And now she's shown how to feed their young and save the adults. She does so via bubbles containing special fats which coral larvae consume. You spent a long time in Thailand, did you?
I did, yeah. That's where I actually saw corals for the first time. So I went on holiday when I was 21 and finished my undergraduate degree. And I'd always wanted to go diving. And so I went underwater and the first thing I saw were these really colourful rocks. And it was like nothing I'd seen on dry land. And I was just amazed. It was just so vibrant and so colourful. And there were these fluorescent pinks, neon greens, bright blues. It was like a little underwater rave. And I was fascinated. I'd never seen anything like that. And I came up from my dive and I asked my instructor what those colourful rocks were. And he explained that they're coral and that coral is actually an animal. And the colour that they get is from when they're really stressed, they have this response called bleaching. And everyone, I guess, thinks of bleaching as it goes white, but it's not always white. It goes these vibrant colours as well. And so the colours that they were is because they were really stressed. And I thought if something could look that incredible when it was stressed, imagine what it could look like when it was healthy. And so, yeah, what was meant to be a two-week holiday ended up being 4 years. And I founded the marine conservation organisation Big Blue Conservation in collaboration with Big Blue Diving on Koh Tao in Thailand. And here we did a lot of ecotourism. We supported researchers to come out there and do on-the-ground work. And we did a lot of restoration work as well with the local stakeholders. So,
how seriously is that taken these days? Because I tend to associate Southeast Asia with fishing using dynamite and pirate ships doing the most ghastly things. And that's one of the reasons I don't go there, because it depresses me. So are you suggesting they're moving in the right direction?
I haven't been there for a long time or worked in the restoration space there for a while, but they're understanding the importance of their ecosystems more and more and the longevity of that, what a healthy reef could offer versus the short-term effects or outcomes of dynamite fishing, for example, or cyanide fishing, which isn't widely used in Thailand. It's more associated with places like in Indonesia. But yeah, I think that there is a mindset moving from short-term gains to long-term things, especially in terms of ecotourism and all of the benefits that that offers them. But corals are incredible. They provide a living space for about a quarter of all marine life, including fish that support fisheries. They protect our coastlines. They are a cultural and iconic asset. They offer a source for new medicines, so medicines for Alzheimer and cancer we found on corals. So not only do the corals need us to help them, but we need them. And they're too important to lose.
Yes, you mentioned Indonesia just now, and of course the extraordinary number of islands and so many reefs. And one of the worries we had was that they're burning after the crops, and the smoke descending on the reefs was turning out to be a problem as well. But as to your work and recovering those little babies, if you like, the corals growing up, do you really feed them little bits of fat?
Yeah, we do. We feed them little balls of fat. Oh, they themselves are essentially little balls of fat. And so when we were thinking about what to make a baby food out of, we thought, well, that would be the first thing to try. And it had great success. Yeah, so we feed them fat, and obviously fat normally floats on water. We have suspended the fats into the water through encapsulating them in, sounds fancy, it's called nanoparticles, but they are actually just, again, little bubbles, and within the bubbles is where the fats are contained, and it helps keep them suspended in the water.
But of course the corals can't move around, so are their hands out there waving?
Well, yeah, the coral larvae, they're swimming, so they can capture it from the water, but the adult corals, we can feed them directly over the adult corals. We could supply them with food, and it's done in aquaculture for aquarium and hobbyists. They've been feeding corals for years, but what we still really don't know what corals need and when they need it, and that's really what my research is looking at, is it's what do they need, what nutrients do they need, under what conditions.
Yeah, and especially the youngsters, because if you look after the youngsters, your research seems to show the adult established ones are much, much healthier. But you've done experiments actually out in the water with some sort of floating device. How did that work?
Yes, there are definitely more high-tech versions out there, but the first prototype we used was in collaboration with an ecotourism operator, GBR Biology, and the Sea Ranger program that they operate out there with the traditional owner groups from the Gungandji and Irukandji communities. And so we had to do something quite back of the envelope in this case, and we just took kids' paddling pools and cut out the bottoms of them, and then some wonderful people made these nets that hung over the pools and into the water and stopped fish from getting in and eating the coral larvae, and also prevented the larvae from escaping until we wanted them to. And yeah, we were able to feed them in these little paddling pools and then release them into the wild. Yeah.
And all you have to do is multiply that by about a million. Mm-hmm. And as we say, it's almost a cliche now that the Great Barrier Reef is the size of Italy, let alone the other reef on the western side of Australia. So how do you scale up?
Yes, I mean, as you say, so we were able to feed in a single pool 8 million, and we had two pools, so we got 16 million fed. That's 16 million potential corals. How do we scale that up? Well, it's not far-fetched to think about irrigation lines in coral reefs, for example. They do that already in the Red Sea. I'm sure there was a period when people thought, how do you feed crops, like on a large scale? And I'm sure this is where integrating science with technology and engineering and other industries is really important. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to answer every single question on my own, which no scientist can do. So it's a really important part of being a scientist, is that you have these collaborations with people who are experts in the other areas, and they can take it from lab bench to benefit.
What about manganese? Where does that come in?
So manganese is a trace metal. The students in our group have identified that, and across the world as well, the groups in Monaco have identified that by increasing the availability of manganese, you can support photosynthesis of the tiny little algal cells that lives in the coral tissues. And actually, that's where corals get a lot of their nutrients from, is from this algae that lives in their tissue and gives them their normal colours. And so, yeah, by providing them with a manganese or a targeted supplement through these trace metals, then that has been shown to support their photosynthesis during times of heat stress when the algae may normally not perform so well.
I know it's an impossible question, but are you optimistic about the fate of the reef?
I'm incredibly worried about the reefs, especially when you see the impacts that this year's El Niño is having in Europe already. I think we are in hot water, if you would, but if all of these incredible restoration tools, these innovative things, are really important to address the challenges that are facing ecosystems like coral reefs, but it's really only buying time for reefs until we get our act together on climate change. We really need to make those fundamental changes. But yeah, restoration is a really important tool in that toolbox of making sure corals can survive this century, because without it, then we wouldn't be able to increase the sheer numbers of corals on reefs and the genetic diversity on reefs that may allow them to adapt to a changing climate.
You cheer me up. By the way, an impossible question. I didn't quite hear the name of your daughter. She's not called Coral, is she?
She's not called Coral. Her name is Cora. She is named after Coral. My husband wouldn't let me name her Coral, so we settled with Cora, but I have Irish descendants, so it was very fitting for us. But yeah, her name is Cora.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And the congratulations are there for Dr. Jennifer Matthews being a finalist in the Eureka Prize Awards to be announced on September the 3rd. She is a Chancellor's Research Fellow at UTS. Dr. Adam Rose is also trying to care for coral reefs, especially the Great Barrier Reef close to his campus at the Central Queensland University at Rockhampton. For years he's been examining our mighty rivers, such as the Fitzroy, and trying to see why they flow so quickly, carrying vast amounts of soil and refuse out to sea, and how to slow them down. Is anyone listening? Farmers, yes, but what to do?
Well, it depends on what's in its way. So if there's nothing there to stop the water, then it will flow that fast and have that carrying capacity to carry sediment and rocks with it. But I think historically, you wouldn't have seen those velocities in a system like the Fitzroy, for instance, before colonisation.
Why not?
Because the Australian environment was very different back then. We hadn't had any hard-hooved animals, so no sheep, no cattle. And so if you think of the soil 200 years ago, 250 years ago, it was a lot softer. It was a lot spongier. It had a lot more microbes growing in it. There was a lot more shrubs. We hadn't cleared any of the land. And so when it would rain, the water would penetrate into the ground nice and gently. It'd then filter through that soil profile and into the creek or the river and then travel downstream. In that creek or river also, you've got debris, trees, rocks, all sorts of things. And then inevitably, you clear the land, you compact the soil, you desnag the rivers, and it's no wonder the water travels at such velocities.
Now, in the old days, before European people turned up in numbers, were there skills that Indigenous people had in various parts of Australia really to adapt that water flow to stop it going too quickly?
So every catchment will be different. So if we were to think of Australia, there's over 200 catchments. And then, Robin, if you have a look at the Indigenous map of Australia, and then you have a look at where the creeks and rivers are, it's no surprise that most mobs had their own system. And so they did have unique ways of doing things for their specific system. But for me, it was that beautiful old way of doing science through observation.
Yeah.
So for generations, they'd see things and make certain changes. But it's that connection, it's that long term, it's that looking at the river and seeing how it behaves at different times. Once you have that understanding, then you can put in little rock walls to catch native fish or something like that. And so for me, it's the Indigenous way of doing things is basically ecology.
Yeah. And some of those fish traps are gigantic, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, tremendous. And, you know, I still think I see remnants when I travel up certain systems, particularly on the mouth of our creeks or rivers. Sometimes I'm not sure if it is or not, but to me, when it looks nice and symmetrical and lined up, that's usually not nature, is it? It's usually a human intervention there.
Yeah. And how much conversation do you have with some Indigenous people about ideas to slow down the water as they used to?
Well, I was lucky, Robin. I suppose throughout my undergraduate, I was lucky enough to study with Doorumbal elder Malcolm Mann. And so we did our undergraduate together. And every time I have another quirky idea or a concept, I make sure to go and have a chat with Mel, see, does he have any information from the elders? Is there any stories that match in? One of the fun ones, Robin, I suppose, in the last couple of years I've come across, talking about slowing the velocity of the river down and giving the river back some more water. mob were saying that the river's healthy when it's singing. And my initial response to that for a couple of days was, how can I get some microphones and put them under the water and record this? And then all of a sudden I had this picture in my head of one of the elders with his head under the water in the river listening, and thought, oh, obviously that's not what they mean. It was the environment around it's making noise, the animals making noise, the river's flowing and it's singing. And so that concept fits in really nicely, I suppose, with my slow the flow type of idea.
Slow the flow. How many people are studying that around the country at various universities and agricultural systems?
I would say it's not actually part of our curriculum yet, Robin. You're seeing concepts come similar from permaculture, regenerative farming. I think the godfather, Peter Andrews, was the first one with his leaky weirs to come up with the idea. But from my perspective, doing my undergraduate degree in environmental science, my honours on Lake Awonga near Gladstone, the dominant narrative was that dams are a bad thing and they'll never fill back up because of climate change. So I still think that we're sort of in that reality where we're still thinking of dams and weirs as of this negative thing, whereas hopefully people can start to see, and in the last few years, that even New Southerners have experienced floods. That's something in Queensland we're very used to. And so I actually think that the general public of Australia are a bit more open to the idea of dams now.
No, well, I know it's far north, but Lismore is a tragic example of just the extent of it.
Absolutely. It's situations like that where the Australian conditions are unpredictable. When we lose lives in floods, it's a tragic loss. Some of the farms that I've seen, Robin, are just tremendous.
Tell me.
One farm in particular, just north of Rockhampton. I was there last winter. My professor from Ohio State had come over. He's a cattle reproduction expert. And he met this farmer back in the 80s where they were looking to improve the fertility of Brahman. And so that was my little intro into that farm. And what he's done is he's just beautifully contoured the land so that any of that rain that falls, it doesn't just quickly rush away. It soaks into the environment. And when I was there, believe it or not, it was green in the middle of winter. And for our southern listeners in Queensland, it is never green in winter. And going onto that farm, Robin, was a real eye-opener. Coming from farming at Charleville myself, where it was rarely ever green, to see a farm in the middle of winter with a really high stock capacity, if we could just replicate that everywhere.
Can you give us a quick summary about some of the measures that you recommend that people can mostly do?
Okay, so we talked earlier about how before colonisation, the water would soak in and have that chance to filter into the rivers or the creeks. What happens now is as soon as it rains, that water rushes away, carries the soil, goes into the river, and in the Fitzroy's case, the largest catchment to drain into the Great Barrier Reef, I think in the 2011 flood, Robin, we had 760 or more Sydney harbours worth of fresh water leave our system. And so the idea is simple, slow the flow. There's a million different ways to do it. We can contour the land, we can have weirs, we can have dams. But some of my solutions, Robin, don't exist yet. The types of structures or dams for slow the flow not only have to hold water back, but they have to allow passage of our native species of fish across them, so with fish ladders and the like. Each creek, each system would require something slightly different because each creek has a certain amount of water that travels down there at certain heights. And so we'd really need to have what I would call bespoke dams that have fish ladders. What happens now, Robin, is we get a flood. That flood lasts maybe a week or two. We've got good conditions for a couple of months and then it gets dry again. Historically, when it would flood, that flood would last a lot longer. Then those good conditions would last a lot longer and the drought would be minimised. But at the moment, what we're doing is we've reduced the flood times, we've reduced the good times, and we've increased the drought times.
What would you like to see happen, given this knowledge you've got?
I'd like us to start to see dams and these things as something that we can use to heal the environment, Robin, rather than seeing it as bad for the environment. I think the old traditional dams were probably correct in not being terrific for the environment. But think of the dams as band-aids. If we don't do anything, the systems themselves get worse. So an example with the Fitzroy, every time we get that flood, in the olden days, it used to go across the floodplains, so it spread wide. Because it travels so fast now, our river just gets sort of dredged out every flood, so it gets deeper. And so every flood we have makes the system deeper, and then the next flood we have will travel even faster because it has less resistance than the previous flood. So until we start to do something and start to invest in the regions and put some of this infrastructure in, we're going to be having the same conversation in 10 years.
Yeah. If you're in Europe, you'd import lots and lots of beavers. What could we use instead?
One of the farmers, Adam Kofi, he was the beef farmer of the year for the Beef Expo. That was his idea with me as well. I don't know, we imported cane toads, we imported dung beetles was successful. But yeah, the beavers, potentially it's a little hot up this way for them. We could have a slow the flow army where we're the beavers.
Young people, Robin. Citizen science, citizen beavers.
Citizen beavers, I like it.
Okay, you got any major plans coming up? Anything in the offing?
Yeah, I'm trying to be clever with this. So what I'm moving towards now, we've got the Olympics coming to the Fitzroy River. So everybody will get to see our system take the international stage in the years to come. And my idea here is to use some drone technology and get some Indigenous and non-Indigenous kids to come in, the ones that, you know, live and play around the system, and get some farmers and some elders to come in with them. And we take some footage of the river and we start to tell our story about what our river is, what it means to us. So I can collect data from the drone footage on algal populations, for instance. But then also we've got these stories that we can collect around our traditional ways of looking at the river, our farmers, the way that they look after the river. And hopefully we've got something then to showcase when we do get that Olympic spotlight put on us in 2032.
Sounds tremendous. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Adam Rose is at the University of Central Queensland, Rockhampton. Slow water for the Olympics.
And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National, where over the past 50 years or so, Robin, you've reported on dozens of developments in human evolution, new species being discovered, all of which have reshaped the hominin family tree. And the classic story of human evolution was that Homo habilis, the handyman, gave rise to Homo erectus around 2 million years ago, which eventually produced Neanderthals and our species, Homo sapiens. But that whole order of things has been called into question for a while now, and recent fossil discoveries suggest that our current way of naming hominin species might need a rethink.
The human family tree, if we start from the present day and work backwards, runs in the sense that you have Homo on the landscape from definitively about 2 million years ago.
This is Jesse Martin, a paleoanthropologist at La Trobe University.
And before that, we have several different genera, most commonly the Australopithecines or Australopithecus, and another genus called Paranthropus.
These three groups or genera, that's plural for genus, Homo, Australopithecus and Paranthropus, they were all hominins. They walked upright, their brains were getting bigger and more complex, but even early Homo species looked quite different to the other two.
And I think a nice way to understand it is that if you look at a species called Homo erectus, which is the first thing that all researchers are happy to put in the genus Homo, and you saw a Homo erectus across the football oval, your first thought would be that's a somewhat strange looking person. However, if you saw a member of the genus Paranthropus or a member of the genus Australopithecus across the football oval, you'd think, oh my, what's escaped from the Melbourne Zoo?
That's because Paranthropus and Australopithecus looked more ape-like than Homo. Body-wise, both had short legs and long arms. Skulls show their foreheads sloped backwards, and Paranthropus in particular had big, flat molars with extremely thick enamel. So it might seem easy enough to sort species into Homo, Australopithecus or Paranthropus buckets, but that is not the case. Take Homo habilis, or handyman. It was discovered in Tanzania more than 80 years ago, and
one of the primary reasons for its inclusion in the genus Homo was that it was found alongside stone tools. Because when it was described in 1964, researchers considered that probably only members of the genus Homo manufactured stone tools. We now know that the earliest evidence for stone tools actually goes back past 3.3 million years ago, well predates any species that any researcher would want to attribute to Homo. So what we've learned in the intervening half a century is, in fact, that there are probably many other genera of hominins that were making stone tools, not just Homo.
Plus, It turns out that Homo habilis probably lived at the same time as Homo erectus, around 2 million years ago. At a site in South Africa called Drimelin, Jesse and his colleagues uncovered fossils suggesting the two types of hominin overlapped in time, meaning it was unlikely that habilis was erectus's ancestor. So Jesse and others suggest Homo habilis should be renamed Australopithecus habilis.
And here is, I think, the thing that is giving a lot of researchers pause about Homo habilis, and that is from the neck down, Homo habilis is a bog-standard Australopithecine. It is short. It has long arms, like a chimp. It has adaptations in the hand that indicate that it was still doing quite a lot of climbing, like the Australopithecines. So while there is a little bit of an expansion of the brain in Homo habilis, and there is a little bit of change in particularly the teeth that make it look somewhat Homo-like, the way it's moving around the landscape, the way it is making a living 2 million years ago, seems to be very much in the Australopithecus space rather than in the genus Homo space.
So what would it take to get Homo habilis accepted and renamed as Australopithecus habilis?
I think that we're probably on the cusp of answering this question. When you find a fossil, almost everything you find challenges assumptions that have existed prior, because there are so few of these things, you find one more and it sort of meaningfully moves the goalposts in terms of what you know. And that's definitely true for habilis. I am going to suggest a kind of seditious answer to your question. While it is true, and I think we've learned since 1964, that there is a lot of things about Homo habilis that are not Homo-like, it is still true that that creature has an enlarged brain and has an anatomical array in the crania that doesn't quite look like other Australopiths. And also now we have another species that sort of, you could say the same thing about in the form of Australopithecus stebi. These are 2 to 3 million year old Australopiths that look somewhat different to the Australopiths that came before them. Another solution to the problem would be to say that actually what we're detecting there, and maybe why we're having this debate about is it Australopithecus or is it Homo, is that the answer is it's neither. It's a new kind of way of being a hominin that we haven't sampled before. And if that's true, then that collection of species deserve, I would argue, their own genus name.
So the question of whether Homo habilis should be reassigned to another genus is still not settled. But when it was thought to be Homo erectus's predecessor, it filled a convenient spot in the hominin family tree. And with Homo habilis vacating that spot, well, we don't know what was there.
There must have been an ancestor. There must have been an earlier Homo erectus or something that came before. But this is a trick of the fossil record where in Eastern Africa, there is really quite a gap in the fossil record between 3 and 2 million years ago. And we don't have much of anything, to be perfectly honest. And of course, that's a problem for understanding the earliest origins for our own genus Homo. I think after 2 million years ago, we have a much better fossil record, particularly of Homo erectus. And so we can sort of start to confidently put things into that species. But before 2 million years ago, I think it would not be an exaggeration to say that the sample, the bin of early Homo is a mess. Most of it is made up of individual and fragmentary teeth. So you will read, for instance, papers that there was one published only last year, suggesting that early Homo is present in Eastern Africa at Leti Guraru 2.8 million years ago. And that's based on a handful, one or two fragmentary teeth that have a couple of Homo-like traits. What we don't have is a full skull, to say nothing of a full skull. You need to be very cautious about making grand claims about the presence of entire genera on the basis of a couple of anatomical traits of the teeth, particularly because we know that some Australopiths eventually evolve Homo-like traits in their teeth. So if you wanted to be conservative and you wanted to look at whole skulls or whole postcranial skeletons and say, when can we be really, really sure that we have a definitive member of our own genus Homo on the landscape? It's 2 million years ago and it's Homo erectus. Before that, I think everything's up for grabs.
While the fossil record between 2 and 3 million years ago is still pretty sparse, new fossil discoveries over the past couple of decades have caused some anthropologists to question whether the current system of three main genera, Homo, Australopithecus, and Paranthropus, is still fit for use. When a hominin fossil is found, it's compared to other species in collections around the world to try to figure out if it's one of a known species or if it's a brand new one. And if so, which genus it belongs in.
The problem is if you find a new fossil, a new site, and there's only one individual or a couple of individuals, it can be very difficult to know where to place this on our family tree.
Ian Towle is a biological anthropologist at Monash University. And until a few decades ago, it was common to classify fossils into grades. These are groups of organisms grouped together based on some kind of anatomical or physiological quality.
So even our own genus, until the 50s, 60s, it was brain size. So if a fossil had a brain of a certain size, it was said to be in our genus. And that was kind of the cutoff. And then the Australopithecus would be anything we found that wasn't a large-brained individual. So you had these two genres that you kind of split this way. And then slowly it was realized that it didn't fit perfectly the actual evolutionary tree of these groups. So especially in the last decade, we've actually, a couple of decades, found some very small-brained species that are in our genus. They're closely related to us. They're potentially closely related to things like Homo erectus. So they're definitely within that group of species, but they've got tiny brains, similar in size to Australopithecus and even similar in size to some living apes. So they don't fit the bill for what would have been described as our genus before. And similar with Australopithecus, we've got this overlap in new species that have got large teeth, thick enamel, similar to Paranthropus. So there's kind of a blurring of the lines, even on the grade-based setup that we had before.
These blurred lines and shared traits could have come from interbreeding or a phenomenon called homoplasy.
So you can get morphology of the skeleton, the shape, size, that kind of look similar but are actually just kind of coincidence from the environment they live in.
For instance, if every hominin in an area is eating the same food, you're probably all going to evolve pretty similar teeth.
They're still very closely related, of course.
But it's just really hard to figure out exactly where they sit on the family tree. So instead of using grades, anthropologists are looking to clades. These are groups containing all the descendants of a common ancestor. And where Homo and Paranthropus are generally considered to be clades, although there is a bit of debate about that too, Ian says the Australopithecus genus is not a clade, it's a grade.
So all major reconstructions in the last couple of decades, they've shown it not to be a genuine clade. And that's because the species in Australopithecus doesn't contain all of the descendants. It's just if we want to have a taxonomy that better reflects evolution relationships, Australopithecus is kind of the main one that has to go. So other fields of biology, they would have got rid of Australopithecus a long time ago.
This clade issue doesn't just lie with Australopithecus. There's some debate around Homo species too, even beyond Homo habilis.
And the other thing with these early Homo taxa, there's Homo rudolfensis as well. They potentially might not even have a common ancestor within Homo. They might be separate branches from Australopithecus groups. So there's potential that our genus is currently defined is not actually a clade either, which adds to the complexity. And even things like Homo florensis, or the hobbits in Indonesia that were found, I think, in the early 2000s, they're a very interesting species. Some people are suggesting more and more that these might be from an earlier taxa, something like Homo habilis, or even species currently defined as Australopithecus. So there's this very complex thing at the moment where we're not actually sure which groups are most closely related to others. We've got a general over idea, especially with the later species. So yeah, it's becoming clear that these large radiations, it becomes very complex.
So is there a simpler way to deal with all this complexity? Anthropologists have been reconsidering ways to classify humans for ages now. Some have considered creating entirely new genus names for fossils that might sit on the blurred boundaries between Homo, Australopithecus and Paranthropus, while others, like Ian, have put forward the opposite. Blend the genera into one extremely inclusive genus, one giant clade.
I think the main thing is if we insist that in scientific writing anyway, in journal arcs, that sort of things, you have to use clade-based taxonomy. Slowly, we'll have to come up with something that reflects that. And then there's going to have to be a compromise, basically. So to be accepted, I think as the fossil record keeps increasing, maybe there'll be a more natural fitting. The reason I think this is a plausible thing is because at this time point, we've got a really good cutoff. So with Australopithecus anamensis, like one of the earliest Australopithecus or the earliest Australopithecus species,
which lived around 4 million years ago,
that seems to be the sister group, so the close, most closely related group to every other hominin after that. So Homo, Australopithecus, Paranthropus, they seem to form a genuine clade. Potentially one solution would be to just take in these, so the last 4 or 5 million years, this large radiation in our evolution, these hominins, to put these into one genus, and then you can kind of describe this complexity within that taxonomic framework. There's lots of challenges to this, like you lose some information, especially because this will include early members that had very small brains, very different behaviorally than we are today. And you include things like Pranthropus that, again, were alive at the same time as some of our direct ancestors. So you're losing some information there as well. So yeah, it's a challenge for the field to come up with a way that we can describe this kind of more and more complex evolutionary record.
Ian thinks it's unlikely that his suggestion will be accepted by the field, and any change would have to happen very, very slowly over years. But whatever happens, he says genus names should reflect genuine evolutionary relationships, clades, not grades. What's needed is a common ancestor in a sweet spot in time, a Goldilocks ancestor, one that lived not too long ago, but also not so recently that you end up with a load of genera, each containing a single species. That's not terribly useful either, because they don't tell you anything about how the various species are related to each other. The issue is finding fossils around that sweet spot to definitively and convincingly identify that common ancestor. Most of what we know about early Homo evolution comes from sites in South Africa and East Africa. And that leaves a whole lot of Africa that's not been explored for fossils. Perhaps Homo erectus's ancestors evolved in West Africa, and their fossils are still waiting to be found. Jesse Martin at La Trobe University thinks that could be the case.
We will find it. It is out there. It does exist. It's just a case of getting out into what are often very difficult places to work logistically. There just aren't that many hominin fossils to begin with. They're a very rare commodity. But I find it fascinating that we sit here in 2026 on the cusp of all sorts of wonderful things like artificial intelligence, discoveries in the fields of medicine, and yet we fundamentally have no clue when our story starts or what the nature of the beginning of that story is.
Dr. Jesse Martin, a paleoanthropologist at La Trobe University. Well before all this chat about where our ancestors fit on the hominin family tree, back in the days of Charles Darwin in the 1800s, a pair of artists in Sydney were producing incredibly detailed and lifelike illustrations of insects and plants, some of which are still being used by scientists today. The artists were the Scott sisters, and they captured Rose Kerr's imagination.
If you've ever used a field guide on a bushwalk, it's likely you've come across a botanical illustration. You know those sketches of a flower or plant that help you identify what you're seeing? The people who create those artworks, botanical illustrators, play an important role in communicating science, from documenting vegetation to providing detailed visual depictions of a new species. The practice is far from a skill of the past, with illustrators today continuing to work with botanists to capture the features of a plant that make it unique. But these artists do build on a rich history of illustrators in Australia, including two young women known as the Scott sisters.
So the Scott sisters actually refers to Harriet and Helena Scott. They're from the 19th century and lived until the early 20th century in Australia, in Sydney in particular, but they moved around a few different places.
This is Darcy Campbell.
I'm an archivist at the Australian Museum. So they were born in like the 1830s, so 1830 and 1832. And they basically became really known as probably the first commercial women artists in Australia that we know of.
The Australian Museum houses a collection of artworks, letters and notebooks from the Scott sisters. You might have heard of them before. They're quite well known for their illustrations of moths and butterflies. And beyond the artistic and historical value of this collection, it highlights the role of these two young women in science. And I really do mean young. Their passion for the natural world started in childhood.
Their mum was the daughter of an ex-convict and lived in the rocks. And the rocks at that time look very different to the rocks today. And so they were surrounded by so much nature along the harbour. I've read letters where they've talked about going for walks around the gardens with their mother and how much they loved it being out in the nature. So that's one side of their journey into science, but the other side is their father. So while their mother was a seamstress, their father was a businessman an entomologist as well, so entomology, the study of insects. And he was really passionate about the natural world. And so it kind of fused into this amazing little environment, so to speak, for the two sisters to really become experts at quite a young age. I think we all have memories of, you know, starting our own bug farms when we were 8 and 10, but they really did. They really started their own bug farm. They would actually collect specimens that they were seeing in the wild, so with a particular focus on moths and butterflies. But they would also bring home the plants that the moths and butterflies were feeding on or were found on. And they kind of, yeah, became pets in a way.
But they weren't just pets. The Scott sisters carefully catalogued and documented the insects, which were pretty unknown to Western science at the time. They'd create family notebooks detailing colours, what the bugs ate, their life cycles, their habitats and more. And Darcy says these notebooks had matching sketches done by the sisters.
Quite literally around the ages of 12 to 14. Wow. And you can see their artworks get better over time because they're slowly learning how to sketch the small details of these specimens.
Eventually, the sisters' father, Alexander, wanted to publish a book to share the knowledge they had documented.
And so then you go from their sketches to beautifully painted plates, large paintings, so like quite a large folio size painting of the specimens they've been documenting this whole time, but they're now turning them into artworks that can be viewed by an external audience.
The plates are beautiful, full of colour and impressive levels of detail. And their work wasn't just limited to moths and butterflies. The Scott sisters created records of plants found in the area and painted the vegetation they found the insects in, which was quite unique at the time.
It kind of has two effects. On the one hand, it shows a scientific commitment, but on the other hand, it also really makes it an artwork. And so you also get a really beautiful artistic illustration of Sydney in the early colony.
And this documentation has come in handy. Species lists from the sisters have gone on to inform revegetation projects in New South Wales, providing important information about what plants previously grew in the area. With the lens of 2026 and our understanding that women weren't necessarily recognised as scientists until relatively recently in history, were the Scott sisters able to be recognised as scientists, or were they seen as more just artists?
It's a good question. They would never have referred to themselves as scientists at the time. Even in that time in the colony, often people referred to themselves as naturalists or botanists or... Yeah, the word scientist wasn't really a word that the Scott sisters themselves would have used, and they would have been described as naturalists and illustrators at the time. But where we really see them as being unique is that they do have their names on all of their artworks. Their father was very insistent that they would be credited for each of their plates and that the work was seen as a family work rather than just his work. So not to celebrate the man in the story, but he kind of is unique for his time to do that because so many male scientists or different specialists at that time would also create these kinds of books, and the women and their families would be intimately involved either by doing the illustrations or helping hand colour or helping file the papers because, you know, this is a huge task at the time without computers, and the women never get credited.
The Scott sisters and their father published their first book in 1864. And in years to come, Helena and Harriet would go on to become commercial artists to support themselves financially. But archivist Darcy Campbell says their impact on science continues to this day.
They also would have built on the legacies of First Nations women who had been understanding butterflies and moths for thousands of years before they ever came along. And so I think it's a continuation of women's role in understanding the world around us.
And there's one extra aspect of the Scott sisters' story that Darcy Campbell doesn't want us to forget.
What I like to focus on is that they were children. They did the bulk of their artworks between 1851 and 1862. So they would have been very, very young at that time, early 20s, if I've done my maths correct, when they did their final paintings, if that makes sense. But their actual illustrations and sketching and scientific materials began far, far earlier when they were teenagers and young children. So I think that's a legacy that I like to carry forward. We actually ran an education program the other day with young people who were similar ages, and it was just such a treat to show them the scientific work that other people were doing at their age and show them that it's not impossible to replicate and that you can also find your own way. And so I think another story here that I am really passionate about is the power of young people to see the world around them and to carry it forward. In a familial context, you know, the fact that they were sisters and stayed friends over the years as well is special. Obviously, there were ups and downs, but I think this is really a story of young people carving out a way for themselves.
Australian Museum archivist Darcy Campbell speaking to Rose Kerr.
There's a butterfly mystery attached to some of our museums in New South Wales, South Australia and Victoria. A case of pilfering, perhaps even fraud? What is this mystery and what was the motive? Peter Bernhardt reviews a book that teases out the strange tale.
Do you remember when Dolly Parton sang, "Love is like a butterfly, soft and gentle as a sigh"? Australian editor and journalist Walter Marsh changes that lyric in his latest book, The Butterfly Thief: Adventure, Fraud, Scotland Yard, and Australia's Greatest Museum Heist. For the author, love is like a pinned and mislabeled butterfly, obsessive, deceptive, and criminal. For over 300 pages of text, followed by 33 pages of footnotes, Marsh shows how one man made off with more than 1,600 specimens from cabinets in the Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide museums. The thief took what he fancied from these institutions over 6 years, but his thefts weren't discovered until 1947, and he had refined tastes. The man took only the rarest of the rare, including what was then known as the flame hair streak, Settlemanus clorinda, subspecies Barringtoniensis, an insect restricted to a few sites in the mountains of northeastern New South Wales. Now, when a museum loses its rarest, that may also mean it has lost one or more of its type specimens. For the uninitiated, scientists must collect and preserve one or more organisms to describe and publish a new species or subspecies. The specimen listed and numbered in the publication becomes the type specimen that future scientists need to examine whenever they plan to question, revise, and/or classify its status as a species and membership in a lineage. There are at least 8 categories of type specimens, including isotypes, paratypes, lectotypes, syntypes, neotypes, and allotypes, but the most precious is the holotype, because that is the single specimen designated for primary reference in the original publication. This also means that the label on the specimen proves its authenticity as a type. I'll come back to this soon, but now we must ask ourselves, what type of person would steal types? Based on the author's in-depth descriptions, I think you might have liked Colin Wyatt if you met him. Almost everyone else did. Unlike Norman Lindsay's gross pudding thief, young Colin was an athletic young Englishman, a competitive skier, mountain climber, folk musician, author, and landscape artist. His extramural jobs as a painter, though, ran in two directions. During the Second World War, he helped produce decoys as part of the Sydney Camouflage Group. Conversely, his talents with a fine brush and pigments let him substitute tarted-up common butterflies for at least 2 rare type specimens in Australian museums, fooling curators for years. In fact, Wyatt was respected as a serious lepidopterist prior to his 6 years in Australia. He specialized in mountain species native to Europe, but that included an earlier attempt at kleptomania in 1930. As young Colin returned the specimens to the museum in England, the theft was hushed up. That explains why he was welcomed by the Old Boys Network of Australian Collectors, including its most prominent contributor and supporter, Athol Waterhouse. It's ironic that Waterhouse, who donated his collection to the Sydney Museum decades earlier, spent his final years trying to identify returned stolen butterflies because Wyatt deliberately removed and destroyed the original labels. All specimens Wyatt took home to England and since returned to Oz now bear a yellow label warning any scientist that they pass through Colin Wyatt's private cabinets. Attempts to reestablish the validity of specimens continue to this day. Walter Marsh wants us to understand the full context of a true crime and punishment story. We must learn about the history of insect collections in Australia and the checkered past of the museums that still keep them. It surprised me to learn that the first butterfly collectors in Australia were none other than the botanists Joseph Banks and Daniel Solander, netting specimens under Captain Cook's protection. Perhaps these men caught those insects visiting the plants they were about to pick and press. We also learn about the early days of skiing and competitive mountain climbing in New Zealand, lengthy divorce procedures under the British Commonwealth, why European spies often posed as butterfly collectors in between world wars, and the dangers of taking small planes to visit Mayan ruins in Guatemala. It all comes together, if you are patient. While I recommend this book to all listeners, I must caution you about its tone, as it wasn't written by a biologist or a science historian. Sometimes the author is careless with taxonomic terminology. For example, the Hesperidae is a family of butterflies, not a genus. Frankly, I don't think that Walter Marsh likes or approves of natural history museums very much, and he treats the life of Sir Joseph Banks as if he was some sort of privileged scoundrel. I suspect the author suffers from what some comedians now call presentism, the belief that modern values are the only way to interpret historical events. If I'm correct, it might do Walter Marsh some good to return to 1966 and listen to Bob Lind sing about chasing the bright, elusive butterfly of love. Don't be concerned. It will not harm you.
And Peter's own book, published by CSIRO, is Unsung Heroes of Pollination, the creatures, including butterflies, who keep our gardens and farms flourishing. But yes, avid collectors of fossils and pinned specimens do like them at home to treasure, and some are never returned.
Next week on The Science Show, astronomers have spotted thousands of exoplanets. These are planets outside our solar system. But now one group thinks they've spotted an exomoon.
Why is it important to be searching for an exomoon?
It shapes some certain ideas. For example, you might hear the idea that moons might be more habitable for life than planets tend to be, because moons can have some additional heating effects through tides. The strongest example we have in the solar system is Io, who the tidal forces from Jupiter and the other Galilean moons are so strong that you have like a very volcanic object that is very heated internally. And so you can have a lot of that energy without necessarily having to be within a certain area around the host star. Like, there's not like a strict habitable zone for moons. And whether or not that could support human-like intelligent life is an open question, but at least, you know, microbial life and that sort of thing could be more possible on moons. It's kind of the frontier of like smaller and smaller object discovery. Like, we started with exoplanets around 30-ish years ago. And then you're kind of going into a smaller mass regime. You're looking for smaller signals that are harder to detect.
Kevin Hoy, an astronomy PhD student at Diego Portales University in Santiago, Chile, speaking to Amy Briggs. That's next time on The Science Show. I'm Belinda Smith. Robin and I will be back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.